headlines, the Yemeni army says it has launched missile and drone attacks on the Saudi capital Riyadh and warns of further retaliatory attacks. U.S. President Joe Biden defends order for airstrikes in eastern Syria despite widespread criticism at home and abroad. And Iran begins the clinical trial of its second domestically developed coronavirus vaccine. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The Yemeni army says it has conducted a large-scale drone and missile strike operation against sensitive targets in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says ballistic missiles and over a dozen drones were used in the operation deep inside the kingdom. Sari said the overnight strikes hit targets at three sites, including those in the Saudi capital Riyadh and the southern city of Abha. He warned that military operations against the Saudi-led coalition will continue and expand until a siege on Yemen is lifted. The attacks follow those on Abha Airport less than a month ago. The Yemeni army frequently launches drones and missiles into Saudi Arabia. That is in retaliation for over 5 years of Saudi-led aggression that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and pushed the country to the brink of famine. Political commentator Hussein al-Bukhaiti says Yemenis sent a message of a warning to Saudi Arabia and its allies with the strikes on Riyadh.
We have seen that the airports like in Najran and in Jizan and in Khamis Mashiq and in Abha, including Riyadh, they have closed for several hours. They have directed many flights to other airports around those area. And this latest operation shows that Yemeni army and ballistic missile and drone unit here in Sana'a are well equipped to take this type of huge operation to target Saudi Arabia. And I believe that this is a clear message to the United Nations, to the UN Security Council, to Biden administration, who have all of them have asked Sana'a to stop attacking Saudi Arabia, but we haven't seen any single condemnation against Saudi Arabia blockade and war against Yemen that have killed more than 300,000 Yemeni civilians. Just yesterday, Saudi conducted a strike on a home in Hudaydah city, killing five civilians and injuring other, four civilians from one family in Hudaydah city. And Hudaydah actually is protected by the Stockholm ceasefire agreement. But this show you that Saudi Arabia actually, they have failed miserably on the ground. They have failed in all their military operations, and the only retaliation they can take is against Yemeni civilians by targeting them directly, like it happened yesterday in Hudaydah, or by tightening the blockade against Yemen. But today, the Sana'a government and as well the spokesperson of Yemeni army, General Yahya Sari', has insisted that attacks will continue against Saudi Arabia, and the only solution is for Saudi to stop its war, its strike, and its blockade.
Syria calls on the United Nations Security Council to take measures to stop what it calls U.S. acts of aggression against the Arab country. In a letter addressed to the U.N. Secretary General and President of the Security Council, the Syrian Foreign Ministry condemned the recent U.S. airstrikes on Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups on the Syrian border. The ministry warned that such actions can escalate tensions in the region. The U.S. attack also drew condemnation from the director of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani slammed the raid as an act of organized terrorism aimed at boosting Daesh terrorists. Shamkhani made the remarks during a meeting with a visiting Iraqi foreign minister, Fuad Hussein. U.S. President Joe Biden has sent a letter to Congress explaining his justification for Thursday's airstrikes in eastern Syria, close to the Iraqi border. In the letter, Biden said aerial raids were carried out in self-defense, adding that they meant to protect U.S.-led foreign troops in Iraq against rocket attacks. The attack targeted the positions of Iraqi counterterrorism forces. The U.S. has time and again blamed Iraqi resistance groups for targeting American missions and forces. The assault on Syria was the first of its kind under the new U.S. administration. However, it has been criticized by some Democrats in U.S. Congress. The raid also sparked international condemnations. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says Biden's justification is senseless and the attack on Syria is an act of aggression.
You know, self-defense. If this is self-defense, then I'd like to sell you some land on the moon, because this is not self-defense. This is an act of aggression. But also, it doesn't make sense because the people they attacked are actually fighting, you know, Daesh, the Islamic State, which were the most effective forces fighting the Islamic State, as are these other groups. Iran and Iraq and Syria have all been fighting the Islamic State. And the United States says they fight it. But when you look at what they do, they keep bombing the Syrians, keep bombing the Iraqis. They assassinate the, you know, General Soleimani and other leaders that have been actually most effective in fighting the Islamic State. So it really rips off the cover. It shows the United States is using and supporting ISIS and Daesh. The Americans are punching, and I guess Biden is sending a message. But, you know, I don't know what sort of message is going to be sent by the military forces and popular mobilization units in Iraq and other organizations and units that are fighting Daesh. But the United States seems to be trying to reestablish Daesh in the area to give them a pretext to stay in the area. They're illegally in Syria. They're building a military base there. And they're stealing oil. Mm-hmm. All of these things make no sense. And in fact, are clearly illegal under international law.
Iran has started the clinical trial of its domestically developed coronavirus vaccine. Two volunteers received a Razikov Pars vaccine doses during a ceremony attended by government officials in Tehran. A total of 133 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first human trial stage. The results will be analyzed and reported to the health ministry. Kov-Pars, developed at Iran's Razi Vaccine and Serum Research Institute, is administered both through injection and inhalation. It is the second indigenously developed COVID vaccine currently under clinical trials. The achievement comes at the time when the country faces difficulties in importing COVID vaccines due to U.S. sanctions. Now, Iran's Royan Institute has created a transgenic mouse that can be infected with the coronavirus. This is a breakthrough for testing new COVID vaccines that allows researchers to study the side effects without direct human trial. Youssef Jalali reports.
Lab rats have always been used as guinea pigs for testing brand new medicine. But when it comes to the coronavirus, the story is different. Mice cannot be infected with the coronavirus, since they do not have the receptor that hosts the virus. To scientists, however, there's always a way. Iran's Royan Institute, which specializes in biomedical and stem cell research, has created transgenic mice with a human receptor on their cells. The receptor, called HACE2, is the one that the coronavirus uses to make its way into human cells. This means the genetically modified mice can now catch the virus.
We transferred a human version of this receptor called ACE2 to the mice, and now our transgenic mice can basically get the virus, can get the disease COVID-19, and they are a good model for the basically studies that aim to investigate the drugs, medical procedures.
The transgenic mice can be used to understand unexpected clinical manifestations of the coronavirus infection in humans.
It will be useful for those aspects of COVID-19, which are basically more or less unknown right now. And we hope that it will uncover more details about the disease process itself, and also It will be useful for other possible new types of coronavirus, which may appear in future years.
Experts at Royan Institute say the mice can also be used as a viable stand-in for humans in testing potential vaccines and therapeutics.
Basically, any types of vaccine which is proposed for this specific disease can be used on these mice. So we are providing these mice for other researchers in the country to use it before they try it on human, and they can get more information from the mice, because you can easily dissect mice and see what's happening inside the bodies, the organs. You can't do that with human, right?
Royan Institute is currently developing its own COVID vaccine. The preclinical stages will involve testing the vaccine on the genetically modified mice. Royan's vaccine is one of the 8 jabs Iran is developing. 2 of them have so far made their way to the human trial phase.
Since the virus struck in Iran, Royan Institute has stepped in to join the fight against COVID-19 by mass-producing test kits. And now that its vaccine is lagging behind in the race with its domestic rivals, the leading biotech firm says lab results show that the vaccine is a promising candidate. It will soon enter the animal trial phase. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The United States has approved a third coronavirus vaccine for emergency use days after the death toll from the pandemic in the country topped 500,000. The Food and Drug Administration said the single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine is highly effective at preventing severe COVID cases. That's amid concerns over the vaccine's only 72% efficacy in clinical trials. The figure falls significantly short of earlier approved vaccines that have over 90% efficacy. President Joe Biden has, however, hailed the approval of the new vaccine as exciting news. But he warned against Americans letting their guard down. COVID-19 has infected an average 69,000 people in the U.S. over the past week. That is a plateau authorities are trying to break with new jabs. The U.S. remains the world's worst affected country by the pandemic, both in terms of infections and deaths. Meanwhile, Brazil's health ministry reports over 1,300 new coronavirus deaths for the 5th day in a row. The country also registered nearly 62,000 infection cases over the past day. Brazil has suffered an enduring second wave since November, and infection rates have not begun to fall. The country imposed lockdown measures in the capital city, Brasilia, to combat the surge in cases. According to official data, the country has so far registered more than 10.5 million infections since the pandemic began, with nearly 255,000 deaths. Meanwhile, in Latin America, Mexico has logged over 750 new fatalities, raising its total death toll to over 185,000. In Argentina, thousands of people took to the streets of Buenos Aires to protest the VIP vaccine scandal that has shaken up the government. Demonstrators banged pots and pans in front of the presidential palace and carried signs reading, quote, "Give me back my vaccine, and vaccines should not be a privilege." Last week, it was revealed that a dozen people had been able to use connections to get access to COVID-19 vaccines. Argentina's total coronavirus infections surpassed the 2 million mark last week. The country has also logged more than 50,000 COVID-19 deaths since the pandemic began. EU leaders have expressed concern over the spread of COVID-19 variants within the 27-nation bloc, amid criticism that vaccines are being administered too slowly. The handling of the pandemic in the EU is contributing to the economic uncertainty and social inequality. Jerome Hughes reports.
Like millions of other young people in the EU, Charles Prevot feels he has not been given adequate support by authorities during the pandemic. In order to survive, the entrepreneur has purchased his own hot dog stand, which he operates in Brussels.
I was working on a restaurant, I was managing a restaurant, and I lost my job, and I was like, what I can do next, what we can do, what the young people, the young men, the young ladies in this world, in this city, in this country, what they can do, because we don't have any help.
As businesses continue to fold in the EU and millions lose their jobs, people feel there is no hope. Only 6.4% of the bloc's population have received a vaccine. That's tiny compared to the UK and US. A two-day video conference involving EU leaders has just concluded. They are very concerned about COVID-19 mutations.
The B117 is by now in all member states but one. The South African variant is in 14 member states and the Brazilian variant in 7. So there's a lot of challenge ahead of us.
Variants are allowed to flourish when people are not vaccinated. Experts say the bureaucratic structures of the EU have resulted in citizens having to wait far too long for vaccines. However, EU leaders say producers are not keeping their promises in terms of supply.
We want more predictability and transparency to ensure that pharmaceutical companies comply with their commitments.
Health officials warn mixed messages from EU leaders about the efficacy of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine are making citizens reluctant to take the jab. Two other vaccines have been approved here, but supply remains a big problem. A fourth vaccine from Johnson & Johnson is likely to be approved next month. During their summit, EU leaders talked at length about the importance of developing certificates to show people have been vaccinated in order to open up travel. Commentators are describing this as laughable, saying it is putting the cart before the horse, given the current state of play with respect to the rollout of vaccines. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Fresh protests are held in the Spanish city of Barcelona as the unrest over the jailing of Catalan singer Pablo Hasél shows no sign of abating. Protesters vandalized shops and banks and set trash bins on fire. Police made 10 arrests. Hasél was arrested last week and sentenced to 9 months in jail on charges of glorifying terrorism and insulting the Spanish monarchy in his songs and tweets. The arrest has sparked a debate on the freedom of expression in the country. At least 6 people are killed and several wounded in Myanmar as police crack down on protesters to end weeks of nationwide demonstrations against the February 1st military coup. One of the flashpoint cities was Yangon, where police threw stun grenades and used tear gas and fired into the air to disperse protesters. Police also opened fire on demonstrators in the town of Dawei. Myanmar was thrown into chaos when the army seized power and detained elected government officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The military claims that the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. The coup has drawn condemnation from many countries. Now, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
A few points about the Barjam, JCPOA, and the reductions in the commitments of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The second point is that the decision by the Majlis and the administration to cancel the Barjam commitments is the right decision. It is a completely reasonable, logical, and acceptable decision. When the other side fails to honor all of its Barjam commitments, then it does not make sense for the Islamic Republic to honor all of its commitments either. That is why, since some time ago, they have gradually begun to withdraw from some commitments. Recently too, they have withdrawn from some others. If they return to their commitments, we'll return to ours as well. I have said this from the beginning, since the very beginning. When the issue of the Barjam arose, I said, commitment in return for commitment. We will make moves in proportion with theirs. Whatever we are supposed to do should be done equally by the other side. Well, this was not done in the beginning, but now it must be done.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith. To be stronger than the
good Tadani wal-ikrami Sayyidul akwani Huwa al-mannan Tadani rabbun azeemun Laysa li rabbun siwa Huwa al-rahman
Another issue that would not be bad to be discussed, I have written it down, is that I have heard some people have questions about my comments in a television program recently broadcast. In that program, I said that a young Hezbollahi administration should hold office, and I said in another time that it would not be a good idea to eliminate the veterans. And such people believe that these two comments do not add up. However, I would tell them that they are not completely compatible and they do not contradict one another in any way. Notice that. I firmly believe in reliance of young forces, and this belief is not related to the present time. I have believed this since long ago. Trust in young forces means that firstly, some important managerial tasks should be entrusted to youth, and secondly, we should welcome some of the innovative ideas that they put forward, and also their energy and enthusiasm.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. The Brereton Report, released in late 2020, documents alleged war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. An inquiry into war crimes committed there by British Special Forces as well was also concluded just a few months earlier, with many similarities. This is a topic that is often overlooked and underreported, especially given the severity of the crimes. Let's take a closer look at what we learned from these inquiries. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2001, Australia invaded Afghanistan along with the United States and the United Kingdom. 20 years later, these countries are still occupying Afghanistan after promising they would bring peace and stability. Stupendous amounts of money, resources, and manpower have gone towards this occupation, all in the name of nation building. And as it turns out, a lot of these resources have been used to commit horrific acts against the people of Afghanistan. In late 2020, an inquiry into war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan was finally released. This 465-page report, titled the Brereton Report, was initiated in 2016 and took several years to complete. The report found that 39 Afghan civilians were alleged to have been unlawfully killed by or involving Australian Defence Force members. None of these alleged crimes took place in the heat of battle, and the victims were non-combatants or no longer combatants. The report is broken down into three parts. However, a lot of it is heavily redacted. Not just the names of individuals, but in some cases, entire events are redacted. One of the shocking practices revealed in this report is known as blooding. This practice is another extremely disturbing aspect of these war crimes. Essentially, what would happen is you'd have a platoon commander who would take a new squad member and have them execute a detained prisoner. The prisoner would be unarmed, in cuffs, and posing no threat whatsoever. The term used in this report is also of interest because they referred to this as an unlawful killing. What it really is an execution. It's cold-blooded murder. Calling it an unlawful killing is just a way to water down the horror of what we're discussing here. But you can't do that. What we're talking about here are war crimes. We're talking about murder. There is no way to sugarcoat atrocities like this. Another practice that we're also made aware of is throwdowns. Basically, what this means is that special forces would carry weapons that are not regularly issued by the Australian or British military and then plant them on a prisoner after executing them. They would throw it down on the ground next to them, a throwdown. This would make it look like the prisoner wasn't executed, but instead killed during a firefight or because they had supposedly pulled a knife, for example. None of which was true, of course. It's important to note that the Brereton Report is not in fact a criminal investigation, but an inquiry conducted by the Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force. This is a role that is separate from the chain of command in the Australian Armed Forces and is appointed by the Secretary of Defence. The Brereton Report makes a number of recommendations following the inquiry, some criminal, others promotions, others pardons. However, it's not clear which cases they're referring to because a lot of it has been redacted again. Another war crime, which didn't come from the Brereton Report, but is still one of the most striking nonetheless, is a video that was released by Four Corners. It shows three men from the Australian SAS chasing an Afghan farmer with a German shepherd. They catch up to him and gather around him as he's lying on the ground. At one point, one of the SAS can be heard asking if he should drop the man. There's an inaudible answer, after which we see him execute the Afghan farmer at point-blank range using his machine gun. It's sickening, it's grotesque, and it's a war crime that makes someone feel physically ill just by watching it. The man who was executed in the video was 26 years old. His name was Dad Muhammad. They said later that he was carrying a radio, supposedly, and that this proved that he was an insurgent, and that's why they killed him. This turned out to be a lie. There was no radio recovered. And even if there was, one has to ask the question, how does carrying a radio merit an execution at point-blank range? After the release of the Brereton Report, a Chinese official posted a doctored image on Twitter of an Australian soldier with a knife in reference to the war crimes committed by their special forces. What's interesting here isn't so much the image, but the reaction it garnered, particularly from Australian officials. Australia's parliament was outraged by it, and Australia's prime minister issued a statement rebuking the Chinese government, demanding an apology. Apparently, the Australian government is more offended by people exposing and calling out its war crimes than the actual war crimes themselves perpetrated by its own soldiers. David McBride, a former lawyer and major in the Australian Defence Force, leaked evidence of war crimes to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC. After this happened, ABC's offices were raided by police. And I think it's extremely interesting and worth pointing out here that when supposedly liberal democracies like the United States, Australia, and the UK have embarrassing information about them leaked to the press, all notions of freedom of speech and press freedoms suddenly seem to go out the window. We saw this with the raid on ABC, with the persecution of Julian Assange, and numerous other whistleblowers across the years. After leaking evidence of war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan to ABC, David McBride faces 5 charges, including those of theft of Commonwealth property, breaching the Defense Act, and disclosing information without due authorization. This could result in him going to jail for decades. He joins me now to talk more. Thanks for taking the time, David. It's good to have you on.
Thank you, Richie.
So, David, I want to start out with the prosecution that you're up against. You're facing several decades in jail now because you exposed war crimes committed by the SAS in Afghanistan. You detail how you tried going up the chain of command, and they put these roadblocks and obstacles in front of you. Can you maybe elaborate on some of the mechanisms that an institution like the Australian military, perhaps the British and the American military, might put in place to prevent whistleblowers like you from disclosing the truth and exposing wrongdoing?
It wasn't war crimes that I first noticed a problem. It was more that we didn't tell the truth about anything, about small things as well as big things. That the war looked like it was being run to win domestic elections rather than to actually make a difference in Afghanistan. And I started to get suspicious because when I made complaints, they weren't treated seriously. And in fact, the message that seemed to be coming back to me was, shut up, stop making waves, what's going on is way above your pay grade. And there were some things which looked like cold-blooded murders, but that weren't being investigated, or that were just being whitewashed. And I was like, well, how can that be? How can you not look into something which looks like children are being killed?
The Brereton report, which was concluded in late 2020, says the SAS killed 39 Afghan civilians. That's the official figure. How many of those special forces that committed these murders were prosecuted or held accountable? And do you think that figure of 39 casualties is legitimate? Do you think it's accurate?
There's only one person who ever put on a uniform for Australia who was facing a trial and significant jail time at this stage, and that is me. And I think even the government finds that an uncomfortable fact. The report, as you know, was only finished late in 2020, and it wasn't a conviction of anybody. It was simply a non-criminal report, like an inquiry, which recommended charges, didn't even recommend charges. It recommended the police look at those 39 matters and, if necessary, charge people. And the wheels of justice, even when they're sort of being totally run honestly, take a long time. And it's quite possible we won't even have a trial on this until 2030. In relation to the amount of murders, I don't know that it was that many more, but it's a significant number because it wasn't, a lot of people must have known. And that's why it's truly significant, because you'd say a lot of people must have known, a lot of people must have said nothing,
And not only that, what is more worrying than, say, if it had been a 300, was that often we rewarded the perpetrators of the murders. We gave them medals. We made them sort of media superstars. And I think that's the really sickening thing to say. Who gets ahead in our society? You know, the person that does the right thing, or the person who is the most sneaky, the most ruthless, the person that actually thinks our laws are just a joke.
David, are you concerned about Australia's geopolitical standing, its place on the international stage? Because a lot of people seem to see it as doing the bidding of the United States, being in this confrontation with China. Assange is another aspect of that.
It completely is, that it does worry me a lot. We will never move forward as a country until we take a good hard look at what they euphemistically call the strategic relationship. The idea, and that means we just do whatever America wants. And the idea is that they will look after us, if we ever got invaded. But I mean, that's highly questionable. And I would rather stand on our own. They make us buy their equipment. They use us. Obviously, we don't have a very big army, but it has a very potent effect. And it means that when they go on these expeditions to Middle Eastern countries, it doesn't look like they're acting on their own. So having Australian help is powerful for them.
So Donald Trump, he sanctioned the ICC for investigating war crimes in Afghanistan. Israel is now scared that the ICC might investigate them. Do you think that Australia has handled the SAS war crimes adequately? And if not, and I think I already know the answer, but if not, do you think that the ICC should be stepping in to prosecute military officials and politicians involved with that?
I believe the ICC, I believe that was the motivation for the Brereton report. That was the real motivation. I spoke to a senior lawyer back in 2014 and I said, what's going on? There's obviously some big cover-up. There's something strange going on. As I said, we're prosecuting people we shouldn't be prosecuting, and we're not prosecuting the famous guys that need it. And he said, we're worried about the ICC. And I didn't understand at the time. I thought, well, the ICC don't have any jurisdiction in Australia unless it's pretty serious. Well, I didn't realise that it was a lot more, it was serious enough for the ICC. They knew it back in 2014. And everything they've done since, because the ICC can't prosecute you if you have carry out prosecutions yourself. I think they think they're being really clever, because imagine it's not clear what carrying out prosecutions means. And so if you're carrying out prosecutions yourself for 50 years, then that probably qualifies, you know, or whatever. By the time they'll all be retired, and the reason why the ICC scares them, the ICC has a tendency to go for the leadership. And this is how, you know, spineless our people are. They don't really care about the soldiers doing things wrong or whatever, but they worry that they might be in the frame and they might get before the Hague. And so they need to find some scapegoats fast, and they need to draw it out. And I think that was the really cynical motivation about Brereton, was to get, because unlike the US, we're a signature, this is typical Australia, going back to Maurice Payne. We can't sign up to these things quick enough. We sign up to anything and we're like, oh, we're such a good nation, you know, we're signed up to the ICC. And I think a lot of the time too, people just want to go on junkets to nice sounding, Rome was where the ICC was put together. But they don't really think about what it means to be a member. And now the Americans, of course, never sign up to it. And now we're backpedaling really fast. We will be complicit, even though we're a signatory to the ICC, a founding member. And the Americans, Pompeo's absolutely outrageous idea that he was going to put sanctions, that he made the ICC the bad guys. Yeah, to try to make out that like the ICC were the criminals, and Australia of course did nothing. And again, this is that creepy thing about you know, being the beholden to the US, we either need to get out of the ICC or we need to say something about that Pompeo's actions, and they're pretty outrageous. But I think that's the, unfortunately, you hang around, you know, the bullies long enough and you become like them. And I think the only reason, yeah, we even did the inquiries was to keep the ICC off our back. We didn't support the ICC when Pompeo was putting sanctions on them. Oh my God.
Because like you said, these investigations, they literally take years. And you also had the UK inquiry, Operation Northmore, where they're investigating war crimes in Afghanistan. And of course, no one is found guilty.
I think that's another good example. I'm glad you brought it up. I think that's what we're getting in Australia. And unfortunately, all these people who work in the government, they've seen the same playbook. You know, make a big noise about something for long enough, throw out money, but then make sure nothing ever happens. The sort of thing they do with political investigations, you know. Whereas if you only care about public appearances, that sort of thing makes perfect sense. You know, if you're not actually trying to do the right thing, just trying to win elections, of course double dealing and mixed messages and playing one side off another, a bit like the American elections, you know, the partisan politics serves a purpose. And if public perception and opinion polling are your goals, your ultimate goals, why not just mess with the truth the whole time? You know, a trial is really just a way to look good temporarily. And if you have to have a trial but make sure the person gets acquitted, that's a win-win as far as these very cynical, you know, reputation management people would go. And pretty much everything that the US, not just the US, but all the Western nations is doing in the middle is a sham.
David McBride, thank you so much for your time. It's great speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your great work.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
The United Kingdom, which also invaded Afghanistan in 2001, is also embroiled in its own war crimes scandal. Britain's special forces, also named the Special Air Service, the SAS, were found to be committing war crimes going back many, many years. These war crimes involved many of the same things we just looked at, such as blooding or throwdowns, and were also systemically covered up by the entire chain of command. An inquiry was also launched called Operation Northmore. Yet not a single soldier or politician was held accountable. These atrocities were reported on years before when the Sunday Times, in cooperation with the BBC, published internal emails showing that troops in Afghanistan were casually discussing these war crimes among themselves. For example, in late 2010 and early 2011, British Special Forces from D Squadron in the 22nd Special Air Service Regiment conducted several night raids in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. During these nighttime raids, they would regularly execute dozens of unarmed Afghani men, committing the most horrendous of war crimes with complete impunity. On February 16, 2011, the SAS stormed the house of a man named Saifullah Gharibyar. They executed his two brothers, his cousin, and his father. All his family members had been unarmed and were already in custody at this point when they were murdered. Afterwards, the SAS falsified their operational summary or OPSUM reports, claiming that these men had brandished weapons of some sort. They did this for practically every raid, these throwdowns. The report goes on to detail how British commanders became aware early on of a deliberate policy of executing Afghani civilians, particularly men. In one email published by the Sunday Times, a major in the SES remarks that there were more bodies than weapons. This clearly indicates that either the weapons had gone missing, or the men were never armed to begin with, and these reports were fabricated or falsified. The numbers literally did not add up. In another email, soldiers casually talk about the latest massacre, indicating how common these occurrences were. The UK's Ministry of Defense claims that a, quote, breakdown of communication, unquote, between the Ministry of Defense and lawyers is the reason that no action ended up being taken. Operation Northmore was set up in 2014 to investigate these crimes, and yet here we are in 2021, and not a single person has been found guilty despite all of these killings. How is that possible? It's extraordinary that none of these investigations, whether we're talking about Operation Northmore or the Brereton Report, have resulted in any successful prosecutions or convictions or even criminal proceedings beginning. How is it that Australian, British, and American special forces get away with murder, literally? The end result of this is that these actions not only disgrace the uniforms of these countries, but also blow a giant hole in the mission these countries allegedly came to accomplish. If their original goal was supposedly to bring peace and stability, this is not it. Executing unarmed men and getting away with murder literally is not nation building or bringing peace and stability and security to Afghanistan. It's a horrendous, brutal occupation that cannot be justified and is ultimately self-defeating. In some cases, when Afghan civilians were executed by special forces, their families were paid compensation by British and Australian troops, who did so without acknowledging any wrongdoing. If you look at the sums mentioned, in some cases it's around $2,000 or $3,000. According to the Sunday Times, in July of 2012, an Afghan mother named Bebe Harasta watched as British SAS shot dead her three sons, Noor, Dean, and Zaire Muhammad, in the courtyard of her own home. They were just farmers. The British then paid her £3,000 and just left. Of course, the British government denies any wrongdoing. And in another instance, reported by ABC, Australian special forces killed a man named Bismillah Azadi and his 15-year-old son, Sadiq Allah, while they lay sleeping. According to Bismillah's cousin, he found them dead and the bed riddled with bullets. The Australian Special Forces had left some cash with the corpse and left. Is that how much the United States, Britain, Australia think Afghan lives are worth? A few thousand dollars? This is not just repulsive, it's extremely insulting and dehumanizing. Foreign invaders come to Afghanistan, kill Afghan civilians in front of their families, pay them a few pennies, and then just move on to the next village or next town as if they did nothing. And the world stays silent and allows this to continue for decades. Is this it? Anyone with a shred of decency would be shocked and offended by what's going on. And these are just the things that we know of. More recently, there's a bill going through the British Parliament called the Overseas Operations Bill, which is extreme cause for concern. This bill seeks to eliminate accountability for British troops who commit war crimes overseas by introducing a statute of limitation of 5 years after the event has happened, if it's even investigated. This means war crimes, torture, abuses of various kinds would go unpunished, essentially. Not just in terms of the soldiers committing the acts, but all the way up the chain of command. No one would be held responsible. It effectively eviscerates accountability for war crimes and does nothing to prevent them in the future. It's an assault on human rights in the clearest sense and an indication that the British government intends to continue the trend of letting war crimes go unpunished. If there's one thing we've learned from these investigations, it's not just that war crimes have been committed with absolute impunity and that these horrific practices like blooding and throwdowns are going on, but that there's also been a systemic cover-up going up the entire chain of command. It's really worth thinking about what is more concerning here, the fact that these war crimes have taken place at all, or that military officials and politicians are able to get away with them and escape unscathed after failing to prevent them from happening in the first place and letting them continue when they knew the horrors that were taking place. Honestly, both are equally terrifying and equally unacceptable, most of all to the victims and their families. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, True Asceticism. Genuine asceticism, which is known as Zuhd in Arabic, and poverty, which is known as Faqr, denote renouncing the unlawful, utter contentment with one's share of wealth, which has been allocated to him by Allah, the source of all wealth, moderately enjoying the lawfully and legitimately assigned property which God has granted to a person, profoundly thanking him for it, subjecting the given wealth to worship purposes, and for pursuing a higher spiritual order of things, that is to say, perceiving wealth as a means rather than an end, keeping the spiritual ailments of greed, extravagance, showing off, haughtiness, and miserliness at bay. In short, a person must be in total control of his assets rather than being controlled by them. And this is something very critical, brothers and sisters out there who are listening to this show. When it comes to your wealth and your property controlling you and your life, that's when it becomes a problem. You should be in control of your property and your wealth. You should be dictating the terms of this relationship between you and the materialism around you and the materialistic blessings of Allah around you. There is nothing wrong with legitimately possessing and using legitimate worldly goods. What is wrong is accumulating, misusing, and finding irresistible the world and its lures. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of true asceticism, also known as Zuhd. Zuhd in Islam, asceticism, spirituality, it is a very beautiful concept. Unfortunately, some people have misunderstood it, and they have taken it to abandon this world, go out in deserts and jungles and live there and not fulfill any of their responsibilities. Know that that is not Islamic asceticism. Genuine asceticism and poverty signify one's destitution, impoverishment, and neediness in relation to God, as contrasted to wealth, ghina, which connotates independence and self-sufficiency. Spiritual poverty is a true servant's enduring attribute of which he is always proud, whereas true wealth, that is absolute independence and self-sufficiency, is an attribute of Allah alone. In this sense, the Quran declares, O mankind, you are the poor in your relation to Allah, and Allah is the one free of all wants,
worthy of all praise. The task of every true believer, therefore, is to actualize the honorable trait of poverty, that is, dependence on and need of God, and to never covet wealth in the sense of being self-reliant and independent from God and His guidance, light, and compassion. So the poverty in the real sense, the Islamic sense of word, when we say that al-faqru fakhri, according to the Prophet, it means that you are faqir and you are poor in front of who? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Your dependence, your ultimate and absolute dependence is on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Here, the hadith does not mean that you intentionally become poor in the worldly sense of the word. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The racial disparities in who gets a dose of the desperately wanted coronavirus vaccine continues to roil the United States. African Americans compose 12% of the U.S. population, yet they have only received 5% of the vaccines. 60% of America is white, and they have gotten 60% of the vaccines. The mainstream media is repeatedly blaming the problem on African Americans by emphasizing their mistrust of the federal government due to a shocking national history of medical experimentation on black communities. However, the small share of whites and blacks who say they refuse to ever get vaccinated is the same, 14%. Multiple studies point to a simpler explanation. Vaccines are overwhelmingly being sent to white neighborhoods. In the United States, vaccines are being issued at places like pharmacies, clinics, and hospitals, but perpetual underinvestment in lower class and non-white areas means many black communities simply don't have this medical infrastructure. Similarly, African American and poor neighborhoods don't have adequate schools, roads, businesses, work opportunities, and many other basic requirements for healthy living. Since almost the start of the pandemic, it's been clear that non-whites are drastically overrepresented in the so-called essential worker occupations, and that non-whites are 4 times more likely to be hospitalized by corona and 3 times more likely to die from it.
And then we also have a lot of our Southside hospitals that are closing and can't meet the demand if they were to get the shipment. They don't have anywhere to store them.